Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Each episode is a conversation with inspiring people who make wonderful contributions to our knowledge in these areas and spark curiosity and ideas to pursue. Join me, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
I do see a lot of great potential, I think, in medicine especially. There's just a lot of ways that we can optimize these processes, that we can have doctors return back to being focused on that patient. And in education, we really focused on the student. And I think that that's has an enormous potential to kind of sort through and let the AI do the bureaucratic work. And let's get back to the interpersonal relationships that make medicine and education work.
Hi there, innovator. It's great to be back with another episode. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. I trust too that you enjoyed my recent conversations with coach, writer, and entrepreneur Kim Arget Singer and with Chris Yankolowski of Remote Staff. I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, J. Scott Christensen. He's an assistant teaching professor of management at the Trulusky College of Business, where his interests are focused on the impact of technology on society and human well-being. Prior to joining the college, Scott was a business owner with decades of experience in video conferencing technology, in project management, and in information technology. He's worked on hundreds of information technology projects and remains actively involved in information technology initiatives and startups. He also serves on the leadership team for the MU Center for the Digital Globe. A quick promotional message from our sponsor, that's InnovaBiz, where we help coaches and consultants build professional credibility, engage their target audience, and connect with their ideal client. That requires absolute clarity about who your ideal clients are and how you can help them. To help you get that clarity about your ideal client, take a look at our Marketing Master Mini Class, where in less than 30 minutes, you'll gain absolute clarity on your ideal client and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. Access the Marketing Master Mini Class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free and accessible without even giving away your email. In our discussion today, Scott talked to me about applications of artificial intelligence and machine learning in medicine, taking care of the analysis to allow more human interactions. He explained some of the dangers of artificial intelligence and machine learning and how companies that collect data use that to influence our behavior. And he also outlined how artificial intelligence and machine learning could enable alternative education models. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Scott Christensen. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Columbia, Missouri in the USA, J. Scott Christensen, who's an assistant teaching professor at the University of Missouri. He's an entrepreneur and speaker, and his interests are focused on the impact of technology on society and human well-being. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Scott. It's a real privilege to have you here today as my guest.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoy getting the opportunity to talk with you and to your listeners.
Now, before we start talking about all things technology, society, people, and related, give us a little bit of a snapshot of your background. How did you get to where you are today in the teaching space and researching all those things? And what were some of the big moments in that journey?
Oh, boy. I took a rather odd route to academia. I actually got an undergraduate degree in biology, started working in a biology lab with a bunch of radioactive chemicals and lab rats, and saw the guy next to me get his 30 years of service pin. And I thought, I got to get the hell out of here before this becomes a career. And left to start working with some schools that were setting up educational networks for distance learning. These are rural schools around Missouri in the early 90s. So got in on the ground floor of that technology and eventually started my own business, selling, installing, and working with that type of equipment, video conferencing or two-way teleconferencing. And that was a lot of fun. Built my own business and ran that for years, and then started teaching part-time as an adjunct professor, and was teaching project management, information systems, found that I really, really enjoyed teaching. Then I went into actually quit that job because I realized it was tying me down too much to be in Columbia all the time. And instead they came back and said, well, you're a really good teacher. We need somebody that can understand the technology and can also teach the technology. And we worked out a deal for to go full time. So that's what I've been doing since 2014. So I'm a teaching professor. So my research obligations are more things that really interest me. So we consider that kind of service to the profession rather than someone that has to, you know, publish or perish. So I really enjoy it. I have a great time learning with my students. So I enjoy looking at these emerging technologies, looking at things like AI, blockchain, all these things that are part of this fourth industrial revolution, as some people have called it.
Mm. Yeah, that's fascinating. So you kind of started off almost in the net of academia and you escaped it, built your own business and then came back, but in a different field.
Yes, yes. And I think it worked out well for me. I really enjoyed that early research, but I'm not sure that I have the discipline that is required for the faculty that are on that tenure track or do that type of intense research, because I always just want to be out there doing something. I want to try the next thing. I want to see what fails. And I don't think that works as well when you're trying to publish or perish. If you publish a paper and say, well, this idea didn't work very well. I don't think you get tenure or promotion if you do that. So I enjoy being more experimental.
Hmm. All right. Now, you mentioned briefly, and we mentioned this in the intro, that your interests are primarily in technology and how it's used, or how the technology and human interface works. And you mentioned briefly there blockchain and can't remember what the other one was, but examples of artificial intelligence that are kind of at the leading edge right now, and machine learning. So what do you think are some of the big trends for both of those areas that are going to impact all of us in the next, say, 5 years?
Boy, that is a big question. And there's a lot of speculation across the spectrum as to what this means. Of course, when we think of AI, some of us may think of HAL from 2001 or other types of malevolent computers. But really what we're talking about with the AI that's being implemented today is this thing called machine learning, where machines are very good at recognizing patterns and they're very good at optimizing different processes. And this can be used in good ways and bad ways, and has its own particular niche of applications. One of the areas that I'm particularly interested in, and we're seeing a lot of development around, is how machine learning can be used for healthcare. So whether it is in the diagnosis of a disease, so for example, an AI being able to help a radiologist focus in on those patients that have maybe a problem or maybe have some unusual problem that needs to be looked at more. Or even just increasing the efficiency by which results are gained. And there's just a lot of really good applications that are coming about right now with using AI in medicine. And in fact, there's been quite a number of devices and algorithms that have been approved for the by the FDA. I think it's over 20 now that are incorporating some sort of AI or machine learning algorithm to help doctors with patient care and diagnosis. So I think that's where we're going to see it in our lives in the next couple of years is when we go to the doctor, it's not just going to be typing in some numbers into an algorithm. It's going to be actually a machine that's looking at these vast patterns and says, okay, well, Scott's 52 years old now, and here's kind of his history. People that have had this history or have this genomic background, so maybe it knows my genes, are going to exhibit this pattern in the future. So we need to look at Scott as far as macular degeneration. That's something that actually runs in my family. So that's something an AI may be able to help optimize my treatment and care for. So yeah, I think that's one of the areas. And I think we sometimes think that this machine learning or AI will replace doctors, but really I think what we're going to see is it's going to augment doctors and make them better at providing individual health care.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a really important point that people have this idea that robots are going to take over jobs. And I think there's situations where that is true. If you imagine an assembly line in, 100 years ago, it certainly was a lot of manual labor. So there are a lot of jobs there for people. And of course, that's much more efficient to do those repetitive mechanical processes through robotics now that we have that technology. But at the same time, the example you gave, I think, is a really good one where there is still a real need for the doctor to interact with the patient because that human interaction is so important. But the doctor having the knowledge of here's this patient's history and here's what the artificial intelligence has identified as patterns that are typical for someone with that history and some of the risks that might come out of that. And now the doctor then is in a position to say, well, proactively managing your health going forward, knowing this information, here's what I would recommend. So that's where the doctor then adds value.
I think so. And I think we'll start to see more emphasis on kind of emotional intelligence in our doctors because, frankly, even now, information isn't the problem, right? If information was the problem, we'd all be billionaires and have six-pack abs, right? Because we know information. It's just that we don't do that. So it's the behavioral parts of that as well. Mm. So you can even imagine an AI that would help us with our behavior. So helping to notice our blood pressure, notice other aspects about our physiology and say, well, Scott, it's time you need to sit down and do a little meditation because you're getting into one of these over-anxious states, right? I know that at the end of the day when I'm done teaching, sometimes I'm pretty wired. I've had a lot of caffeine and it's really good for me to just sit down for a moment before I go home and interact with my family. So I'm not just, totally wired, but I could see even those kind of, assistants. So we have Google Assistant and we have Siri and these other types of applications that might actually help us modify our own behavior, right? Because we probably know things that we should do to eat better, to exercise, to get up from the computer now and then. And we just don't tend to do that sometimes. But I think there's just an enormous potential both at the personal level for a lot of people are trying to measure their own physiology and measure their sleep cycles and try to improve things there. I just bought an interesting little device that I can hold in my hand and then the back of it I touch to my ankle. And it will actually do an EKG, a six-lead EKG, as if I had six leads on my chest. And you can actually collect that data. They are hoping to get approval so that they can use AI to then infer what a full 12-lead EKG would look like. And so that AI is actually being used inside of these things to be able to provide that type of on-the-spot measurement using relatively cheap consumer electronics. That was only a $100 device. I think under medical supervision, that could be a great thing for some patients. Now, there's also the question of, does that cause me to worry about things too much? Like, oh my goodness, there was a little blip there, and maybe there shouldn't be a blip there. And now I'm not going to sleep for a couple of days and I'm going to be upset about it. So there's always kind of a balance. And it's interesting because in other discussions with this, we sometimes come to where this balance is between convenience and creepy.
Yeah.
So when we start to look at things like having these voice assistants monitor our conversations and to tell whether we're depressed and to tell whether we might be at risk of suicide. So Facebook actually has an algorithm now where they look at your posts and they're trying to even develop an algorithm that look into your video posts and see what those videos are about and determine with a fair amount of accuracy whether you might be considering self-harm in some way. So we could say that that would be a wonderful thing, that we'd certainly want people to have that intervention when they need it. But at the other side, where does this creepy level kind of kick in? And I think we all have a balance there that we have to strike for ourselves. I know my mom doesn't even like the autocomplete on Google. She gets upset about that. That crosses over the line to creepy for her. And I think you and I probably take that as read that that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's a lot of interesting points there. I mean, we'll explore that question a little bit more in a moment, but I know from, you know, what you said earlier about the amount of data that you can then collect on yourself, and does that get to the point where you start to worry about small differences there? I know, you know, my wife has one of these fitness trackers, and she tracks her sleep. So the first thing she does when she wakes up is have a look, how did I sleep tonight? And sometimes you're, I had a very restless night. I didn't sleep very well. And I said, at some point I've said to her, but how do you feel? How do you feel right now? Do you feel rested? Do you feel tired? I mean, you know, forget what the data says. How do you feel? Because that's probably the most important things. And sometimes I wonder whether, you know, she's kind of telling herself that she must feel tired now because the device is saying it was a restless night. And that it's a kind of a self-perpetuating prophecy.
Yeah, and I think different personalities have different reactions to that. I have a similar situation. My wife has a girlfriend, and this girlfriend is really monitoring her sleep all the time and is really worried about it. And the accuracy of some of these things is not that great. It's just using your movement, and it may be that that's natural for you. We have individual differences. And that's actually one of the problems that we can see with AI is over-relying on an AI that has been trained on just a particular subset of our population. So for example, if we were training an AI to look at blood flows and potential for heart attack, that might be trained with a lot of data from, you know, white males. And if you're an African-American female, you may have a very different physiology or the way that that heart attack or potential heart attack might manifest itself. And so that's where we get to this idea that a lot of these machine learning algorithms can be very good at what they're doing in a very narrow category. And so we have to be very careful about what data are we training these systems with when we are training an AI to learn how to recognize patterns. And so I think that's something, too, where we need the doctor involved, right? So we need that expert judgment to say, well, this AI is not appropriate for this particular patient or is going to be less likely to predict an outcome.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. And I've experienced that in, well, it's an unrelated aspect, but I guess if you, you know, the thing is we kind of talk about AI, really what it is taking a set of data and then using computers to make predictions based on that set of data for another example. So where I've used it recently, I purchased a new piece of software for my photography, and it's about noise reduction, and it's based on this artificial intelligence, and it's got several models in there. So you can bring up a photo that's got a little bit of excess noise, excess grain in the background or darker areas, and run it through a couple of those models, and it gives you quite amazing results. But what I wanted to say is that some photos don't respond really well at all to one or other particular model, but then if you go to one of the alternative models, it does a much better job. So clearly there's something, and I don't understand how it all works, but my interpretation is there's something particular about that photo that is, it's not suited to one model, but it's better suited to another model. And so I think your example is another example of that, where if you overly rely on it, and you know, in a more critical situation where it's a health situation, that will then trigger some consequences, such as here's how we need to treat you, or here's what we need to do with you to prevent or minimize the risk of this happening. That's much more serious, isn't it? So,
and right,
that's where the doctor is then a really important part of that whole setup.
Yep, and there is an entire field of what's called, it's not a very large field, but called adversarial AI. So this idea that you look at how can you trick an AI, and what criteria is it really using to learn? So when we say machine learning, often what we're doing is we're not even telling the machine what criteria to use. So we're just giving it a bunch of images or a bunch of data, and then letting it figure out what criteria it should use to determine, you know, whether something's a bunny rabbit or whether it's a cat, whatever type of classification we're wanting it to do. One example of that was an AI that was going to be used for autonomous vehicles. They gave it a whole bunch of stop signs. Say, this is a stop sign. The AI was not told you should key on the fact that it's red and that it has this word stop, and it's shaped like an octagon. Things that a child would probably pick up on, right? Mm. They pick up on that stuff. And some researchers found that they could fool this AI just by putting stickers on the stop sign. You and I would recognize that as a stop sign that's been vandalized in some way. Mm. But the AI decided this was some other traffic sign, a right turn only or something like that. Mm. And that's because the criteria wasn't necessarily specified for the AI to look at. And that's kind of the beauty of AI, because we can let it figure out these patterns on its own. But it's something we need to be critical about as well, to think about what is this really keying in on with this particular image, like your example, and why is this not going to work well for other images because of that?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. And it kind of highlights that the human mind is actually a pretty amazing thing, isn't it? That we can, like, without having been told that this is just a stop sign that somebody's put a random sticker on, which you've probably never seen before, but the mind says, oh, that's just a stop sign that somebody's put a random sticker on, right? Whereas right. The artificial intelligence is very, very linear. So it's going to say, well, this is different, so it must not be a stop sign. It's got to be black or white.
Right, exactly. And it also illustrates the narrowness of these applications. So a child is also being trained in language and in colors and in shapes and all sorts of other things that child can then take that knowledge they've learned elsewhere and transfer it into absorbing this new information about oh, mommy always stops here. The car stops moving, and there's that sign. And I recognize that word stop from my class. Whereas an AI is trained in a very narrow area. So if you train it on your pictures, which I imagine are some beautiful landscapes or something like that, it's not going to do well with something that is a X-ray. Right, because it's not going to understand that this is the same sort of thing, or the noise is different, maybe we'll misinterpret that. So another thing that some people don't really think of is how narrow these applications are, that they're not really good about transferring into other areas necessarily.
Yeah, really good point. Now, you touched earlier on some of the risks that we might perceive, or that are probably there as well, in terms of these applications, for example, listening to us on Google Voice and Siri, and how that might play out. Now, I know from my own experience and from what some other people tell us that there is certainly, I think the Google app does listen. Mm-hmm. And I've had experiences where we've had conversations over something, let's say a new phone, and then all of a sudden I start getting served with advertisements specific to the phone that I'd been having that conversation around without having done the searches beforehand. So,
is that convenient or is that creepy?
It's a bit of both. I mean, it's creepy that I think, well, this is like it's reading my mind or it's listening to my conversations. It's convenient if I'm serious about buying that phone, then of course it is convenient. And I know we have our Google Home in the kitchen family room area, and it's set up to work because we're bilingual. So it's set up to understand both German and English, and it will randomly trigger off and say, I can't help you with that, or I didn't understand what you're saying, even though we haven't used the trigger word. So I'm thinking it's listening.
Right. It's interesting where that line is for each of us. And if you think about it, not even with things like voice, but if you use Google Maps, I'm going to go to the hospital. I'm going to go to the Best Buy, the local electronics dealer. That data exhaust gets tracked forever. So it knows where you've been. So now we can even correlate more information about Scott. He tends to go to coffee shops early in the morning. Let's serve him up with an ad for the Starbucks or whatever, Pete's Coffee or whatever it is where he is located. So there's all sorts of data exhaust that gets tracked about us from these quote-unquote free applications. The free applications are there to collect data about our behavior, and that then allows these companies to further modify our behavior in the future. And unfortunately, that's where we see a lot of machine learning algorithms used for, I don't know if I'd call it evil, but I certainly wouldn't call it good. If you look at things like YouTube's algorithm for showing you the next video, right? So they know that if I start to search for moon landing, they might start to show one video that has a conspiracy about the moon landing. Mm. And then you show more and more because conspiracy theories are kind of interesting or funny. So people wonder, why do they get driven to these extreme videos? Well, it's because that keeps you on the site longer. And their machine learning algorithm is recognized a pattern by which it can feed more of this type of information to you and modify your behavior. And so that's where you get Facebook, Instagram, all these free social media applications are collecting this data and are using this data to try to modify your behavior. And in fact, I believe Facebook got into fairly good trouble with this because they experimented on the folks in New Zealand with taking Facebook users in New Zealand and showing them certain types of images in their Facebook feed, and then seeing if they could detect any changes in their mood. they did this all without getting any approval from an institutional review board or something like that, where at the university we would have to go before them and justify such research. And so that's kind of scared everybody a little bit that here's a company that looks like they could, you know, modify our moods. Is that convenient? Do I want something to help me get feeling better when I'm down? Or is that border on creepy? I think it borders on creepy myself.
Mm. Yeah. And of course, there's, you know, Facebook in particular have been in the news quite a bit over the last few years for, you know, how they've, or how people have used the platform, let's say, to manipulate public opinion in, you know, democratic elections.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, that's been especially severe here in the U.S. People sometimes say, well, the election was hacked. And I say, no, the Russians used Facebook just as it was intended. So they paid the money, they targeted the advertising. And that's a big debate we're having with these tech companies is political ads. One of the things that's kind of disturbing about that is that they can micro-target these political ads to such a degree that there may be an ad that's crafted just for me. Mm. And you would never see that. Nobody else in the world would see that. Currently in the U.S., when we have ads that are broadcast on our regular TV channels, those usually get fact-checked at a certain point, right? So maybe you're my opponent. You would say, well, Scott's lying, or the newspaper reporter might do some research and say, well, Scott's lying about this. Now, if I'm serving up an ad that only you see and no one else ever sees, then that's really problematic for that type of fact-checking. Mm. It's problematic for a lot of reasons. Here in the U.S., we allow politicians to lie. We say that's part of our freedom of speech. But lying without having any scrutiny is a whole different game. And Twitter has decided that they're not going to allow political ads, which is, I guess, good, but it's a whole nother situation as far as problems. And Facebook has said, no, we're going to allow political ads. But once again, unfortunately, these AIs sometimes amplify the false messages. So it's really not so much that someone's lying, but the amplification of that message that can become very disturbing.
Yeah, it's. I mean, for me, it's an interesting transition, I think, because if you think back, I mean, even 2 or 3 years ago, there were some grassroots movements that really took off in a big way through social media, and you couldn't imagine those getting off the ground and having that groundswell of, you know, people doing some really good things that required a lot of people to get together and work together to do those. You know, if you think back to the Arab Spring, for example, that kind of change driven from grassroots and from the general population probably wouldn't have got off the ground without social media. But then now it seems to be that the kind of influential people that grassroots movement usually works against or usually works to convince to change things, that they're now using the social media to turn the clock back and impose their will again, if you like.
Oh, exactly. What Erdogan has done in Turkey, you know, to track people down via Facebook that have been organizing against him. A lot of these countries will actually shut down various services. So in Iran, there's been actually a lot of protests by the citizens against their government. And they've shut down not only internet service, but data service on mobile phones so that they can't get organized.
Hmm.
So that's very interesting to see how we have a technology that really looked like it was going to be a liberating technology, and then it's been really turned into a tool of authoritarians. So, and also if you look at what's happening in China with the Uyghur people that are a Muslim minority that the Chinese government doesn't like because of, you know, this religious belief that there's something higher than the state. There's actually cameras that can identify the ethnicity of someone that these are being deployed in China to monitor people, to be able to track people throughout their society. And I think that's just, extremely disturbing to think about how this could be used by an authoritarian state like that. And, it seems like the tables have turned fairly rapidly.
Hmm. Okay, well,
we're heading down a kind of depressing route here, so let's
lift the mood a little bit here. What are some of the things that you see coming down the track that excite you?
Well, I think there's a lot that I see, like in higher education here. We have a lot of inefficiencies with the way that we schedule classes. I'm excited about using that to get at some of the kind of big data problems. I'm excited about students being able to maybe have an AI that would help empower them to learn in the way that is going to be best for them. I think there's some ways that that could be done that doesn't just replace the teacher, but augments it or allows for a just-in-time learning. I think it will also allow us to expand beyond the walls of higher education and be available to our students after they graduate. I would like to see us kind of transition into a lifelong mentor for students as they graduate from here. And so I think having AIs that can help us connect the dots might be an exciting application for the future as well. So I do see a lot of great potential, I think, in medicine especially. There's just a lot of ways that we can optimize these processes, that we can, have doctors return back to being focused on that patient. And in education, we really focused on the student. And I think that that's has an enormous potential to kind of sort through and let the AI do the bureaucratic work. And let's get back to the interpersonal relationships that make medicine and education work.
Mm. Yeah, they're all really great examples of that idea of using technology to enable more human interactions, which right. I think is that's really where the value of technology is. And, we do a lot in marketing where there's lots of technology around where you can automate a whole lot of things, but at the same time, there's a risk there that, and some people have fallen into this, of abdicating all the interactions to technology and forgetting that human connection part. So I think all those examples you mentioned where the technology takes on a lot of things that are challenging and taking up time that take away from the human connections, that free up people to have more of those connections.
Yeah, and I think we could even start to see the class evolve here in the U.S., and my classes are 16 weeks long. Some students have already seen some of the material that I've covered at various points. Why are they having to sit through that? Well, sometimes they just don't. They don't show up and sit through it. I guess maybe they're using their own intelligence.
Yeah, yeah.
But I could see a situation where you have that kind of, I need to fill these knowledge gaps, and I need to do this to meet some objective. I'm going to pop into Scott's class for weeks 2 and 3 because that'll fill out my gaps that I have when I transferred in or something like that. So there's all sorts of ways we could even relate what I'm doing in the classroom and feed that into an algorithm that would help customize things for students. And I would like to see it become even more open. One of the frustrations I have with higher education in the U.S. is that we tend to be highly selective, right? So you can only come into my classroom if you've got this GPA and you've got these other things in place. Well, why not just let anybody wander in? If they want to come in, let them come in.
Yeah.
If they think they're going to get something out of it. So I have a little bit different attitude on that, and I'd like to see how AI could empower people that are here in our community that say, boy, I really need to know something about databases. Scott is covering databases for these 3 weeks in his class. I'm just going to pop over there to Cornell Hall, and I'm going to sit in on his class. That would be something that is, I don't know if that's really a good machine learning algorithm, but that could be something that we could start to enable more as we free up some of this other kind of mundane applications and optimization.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's a really interesting application, and I like the idea of people just popping into lecture streams for the sake of learning a particular subject rather than as part of a degree that they're doing. And it's probably good for the teacher too, because that you start to see a shift in your audience, right? A lot more people there that want to be there rather than have to be there to tick the unit requirements.
Yeah, and I really enjoy having students that are coming back to college, because they will come to me with specific problems. They'll say, hey, when I was working at this bank, here's what happened. How would you handle that? Hmm. And it challenges me and say, okay, well, here's now it's real, right? Yeah. We're not just talking about, you know, theory anymore. Now things are real. And that also helps all the other students in the class realize that, you know, this stuff has real applications and matters to people. The outcome of their businesses, the outcome of their lives are going to be impacted.
Hmm. All right. Well, this is fascinating, Scott. You've shared a lot with us in terms of some of the potential applications of machine learning and artificial intelligence, and we've talked a little bit about some of the things that are going on right now, the good and the bad. And, yeah, you've given us a vision of a couple of things that might be coming in the future. So I think it's a good point to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round. And it's designed to help our audience, who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So probably a lot of this might go back to your years as an entrepreneur, but I'm sure there's things from a teaching perspective that will come into this as well. So there's five questions, and hopefully you'll give us some really insightful answers that will inspire the listener to go and do something awesome today.
Okay, great.
So what do you think is the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Read, read, and read. Hmm. Reading is compound interest. I wish I had really taken reading more seriously throughout my career. I kind of got myself narrowed into some areas and not thinking more broadly. And so now I spend a lot of time every week trying to make sure I make time for reading.
Hmm. Yeah, and there's so much information out there, and it's so easy to access all the information based on the internet.
Yeah, and I would give you a recommendation. There is a book called Deep Medicine by Eric Topol. It came out last year. If you're interested about the application of machine learning in medicine, it's a really highly rated book, and he's a really good writer. So even if you don't know much about medicine or you don't know much about computers, don't worry. It really expands on a lot of the topics we touched on today.
Mm, okay, well, we'll track that down and put a link in the show notes to that book as well. What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Talking with other people. Often we would go to trade shows, and rather than just go to the seminars, my sales engineer and I would start at one end of the exhibit hall and basically quiz everybody about what their products did. And you should get those passes for free for those exhibit halls. And we would spend 2 days just quizzing everybody, and we would have lots and lots of ideas, and we know how different systems work. So when a customer came to us with a problem, we would say, oh, we saw something like that at this place, and I bet you if we got it to work with this other product, that might solve your problem. So just kind of knowing what's out there, knowing the landscape, surveying your environment is really important.
Mm. Yeah, great advice. And trade shows are a great place to do that in particular, because you get to see what's the latest and new things across the board in a particular industry. And it's also good to go and look at a trade show totally outside your own industry.
Yes, exactly.
Hmm. Do you have a favorite resource that you use most often?
Yes, it's one that is based on David Allen's Getting Things Done method for productivity. So mm-hmm. I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of that. It's a product that's for the Mac. It's called OmniFocus, and it implements David Allen's Getting Things Done methodology. It's my trusted system where every single thing goes in there, and it allows me to take a high-level view and to prioritize those things I'm going to do. So that has been a big stress reliever for me. I used to be stressed and I would, you know, grind my teeth at night and not sleep at all. Now when I go to bed, I know if I haven't got something done, I'm going to email the person and say, hey, I'm not going to get this done. I don't wake up in the middle of the night thinking, oh my gosh, I have to get this done. So that has just really changed my life. And that was about 10 years ago. And it's been wonderful.
Mm, yeah, I'm a big fan of the getting things done method of David Allen. So I kind of discovered that probably about 20 years ago and have been using some variants of that ever since.
Oh, good, good.
Not familiar with OmniFocus, but I'm not a Mac user. So, but okay. We will link to that one in the show notes too. Now, what's the best way to keep a project on track?
Well, unfortunately, it's probably a weekly call. I found that I don't like to have unnecessary meetings, but there's something about a deadline, and I find myself motivated by that as well. So if I have a weekly call every Monday morning or every Friday afternoon to report on the status of a project, I'm going to be thinking about that in my mind, like, oh, I've got to get some progress done. I've got to make sure I get this particular thing. I want to report on this. And even just a 10-minute call can be enough. Mm-hmm. So that idea that you might have heard from Agile project management, where you have like a daily scrum where you just have a 10-minute meeting. But doing that like once a week, I find really keeps things on task with your clients that you're working with and making sure that you're aware when things are getting delayed, so you can adjust your schedule appropriately.
Mm. Yeah, communication is so important, isn't it? And sometimes you've having the discipline to do a weekly call like that, it removes the assumptions.
Right.
Mm. Okay, and what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Well, I always tell my students that you want to be the intersection. So think about two circles, like a Venn diagram, and you want to be that intersection of those two Venn diagrams. So for me, that worked out really well in my business. We specialize in video conferencing. That was an area where you had to know networking and you had to know audiovisual. There were certainly companies that were better at networking than we were, but we weren't certainly the worst. And there were certainly companies that are better at audiovisual, but we certainly weren't the worst either. But there were very few companies at the time in the 90s that were doing both networking and doing audiovisual. So it allowed us to get out in front. Same thing with my work here at the university. I'm a technologist. I like technology. I study technology. There's certainly people that are better than me at that. I'm certainly not the worst. Same thing with teaching. I like to consider myself a good teacher. There's certainly better teachers than I. And certainly worse, but there's very few technologists that are willing to get up in a large classroom or to manage the classroom dynamics that you have to do at a university. So I always tell my students to be that intersection of two different things that really distinguishes you from something else. Be the football player that knows about analytics. Be, you know, whatever it is, the IT guy that also knows about global trade and has a global trade certification. Be that intersection, be something a little bit different.
Mm. Mm. That's a really good approach. I like that. All right. Well, thanks, Scott. This has been really fabulous. Now, where can people find out more about you and maybe even reach out and say thank you for what you shared today?
Sure. Well, there's two sites I will share with you. I send out a newsletter about every month just with books that I'm reading, applications I'm using. It's nothing really commercial, but kind of my life hacks. If you go to frt.news, that's Free Range Technologist, you can subscribe there and you can see previous issues to see if that's something you're interested in. I also have a website called learnabout.ai. So it's learnabout, all one word, .ai. And that book, Deep Medicine, other books I've read, other applications you can download and use just to learn about artificial intelligence are there. So it's just a website where I put these links that are kind of hard to, you know, put out on a podcast or something like this. But that's a good place that people can find me there, and they can also suggest things that should be added to that list.
Mm, great. Well, we'll place links in the show notes to include that as well. So people can click through and have a look. It's great.
Great.
Now, Do you have a parting piece of advice you'd like to leave the listener just before we go, particularly for those that want to be leader in innovation and in their field?
Boy, I just have to go back to that, continue reading. That just gives you so much breadth of knowledge. It gives you insight into somebody else's experience, into their lives. If you haven't watched the Bill Gates documentary on Netflix, it's called Inside the Mind of Bill Gates. You can see somebody who's been reading all his life and what that kind of compound interest of reading, how that's really paid off in someone that's really making a great positive difference in the world, or at least is trying to.
All right. Well, wonderful. So reading and, have a look at the documentary about Bill Gates, Inside the Mind of Bill Gates.
It's really good.
Okay. Finally, Scott, who would you like me to chat with on a future Innova Buzz podcast and why?
Well, you might chat with my friend John Howe. He wrote a book called The Foolish Corner, which was probably a bad title for a book, but it's about kind of the psychology behind personal financial decisions. So these biases that get in the way of us making good decisions. Some of you may have heard of behavioral finance, so that type of field of behavioral finance. And he's kind of a funny guy and is a good friend of mine. He was our former chair of the finance department here.
Great. Well, we'll get an introduction to John from you and invite him onto the podcast. I'm sure in that field, there's probably applications for AI as well. Take some of that emotion out of it. But it sounds like we might have a fascinating discussion.
Great.
Well, thanks so much for sharing your time and your insight so generously with us today, Scott. It's been a real privilege to have you here and learn so much more about AI, artificial intelligence, and machine learning, and what some of the applications are that are being trialed right now and coming down the track, and how you see some of the things happening in the future. So I wish you all the best for the future, and let's keep in touch.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed that thought-provoking and informative conversation with Scott and took something away from his episode. He certainly gave us a few scenarios that got me thinking in terms of the benefits of artificial intelligence and machine learning and how to balance that with potential downsides. I'd love to know what you took away from Scott's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Scott Christiansen. That is ScottChristiansen. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Scott Christiansen. There you'll find contact information for getting in touch with Scott, as well as links to his website, to the FRT news that we spoke about, his social media pages, and the other resources that we also spoke about in today's conversation. Scott suggested that we have a conversation with John Howe, author of The Foolish Corner, on a future Innova Buzz podcast episode. So, John, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Scott Christiansen. Remember to check out our Marketing Master mini class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free and accessible without even giving away your email. But most importantly, it will enable you in less than 30 minutes to gain absolute clarity about who your ideal client is and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. And if you'd like our help to go even deeper into marketing mastery, or our help with producing your very own podcast, even launching your very own podcast if you don't yet have one, then send me an email to jurgen@innovabiz.co and we can set up a quick call to have a short conversation and find out whether we're a good fit for one another. Tune in again to the next episodes of the Innova Buzz podcast, where we've got some more fantastic guests lined up, including Anthony Sarandria of Siteflood and Odette Barry of Odette & Co. Stay connected with us by subscribing to the InnovaBuzz podcast at innovabuzz.com/subscribe. innovabuzz.com/subscribe. Make sure you never miss another episode. It would also mean a lot to me if you leave us a review, because what you think matters. I'd love to hear your thoughts, your ideas, your suggestions, or questions you have, so go ahead and share them in the comments below the blog post for this episode. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.